It's showtime.
Go head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Go off and running for this, the third day of June, 2020. This is The Horn. HeadOn.live is where you'll find us on the interweb tube. That's where we put all the really cool stuff that we do here. It's your best access to the live stream when this program is live between Monday through Friday from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 2 to 5 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. And it's also your best destination for all of your podcasting needs. Practically every platform that does podcasting is available to you there. And then, of course, there's the chat room, the means by which we augment the listening experience when the program's live. If you've never joined in on the merry, wacky, zany, real-time multimedia extravaganza that is the Horn chat room, there's never been a better time. You pick yourself out a screen name and a password and jump in, and well, you'll be greeted by by the early arrival gang. That would be Anatole and House of Roberts, Lloyd, Squeaky, Will in Chicago, all just waiting for you. And, of course, capably moderated by pinch-hit midweek chat room utility moderator and all-around great guy, Steve from Georgistan. So, come on in. The conversation's fine. Every program here at The Horn begins with gratitude. This program is no different. And so, consequently, we send out thanks for this third day of the month to our third day of the month subscribers. These are PayPal subscribers. Gene and Ann across the pond, thank you. Thank you to Janice. Thank you to Stephen. Thank you to John. Thank you very kindly indeed. Recalling, of course, that a $10 a month subscriber to The Horn is giving up not quite a half a stick of Wrigley's chewing gum. That's a non-paid product placement. Not quite a half a stick of Wrigley's chewing gum per program, which is not just a heck of a lot when you consider the gajillions of dollars that go into multimillionaire for-profit media that exists only to send you into the tender mercies of someone who or some corporation who wants you to buy shit you probably don't need from them. Yo, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. It's Prayer Meeting Wednesday. Let me send a quick response here. Just letting Steve from Georgistan know I'm good to go on the situation as it stands. Also, thanks going out to Monica. Thank you, Monica, very kindly. Here's the here's the lowdown for fundraising for this middle of the week. We have actually, after last night's challenge and the response to it, and thanks to Monica, well, doggone it, we're done with fundraising for today. So I'm not going to mention it any further, but if folks want to jump in or anybody wants to be a new subscriber, that's awesome. And if we can get out in front a little bit, you know, hey, if we could get to the point where we had a few days of fundraising free radio at the end of June, that'd be wonderful. But thank you very kindly. And since the Cathedral of Common Sense is still shut down for the pandemic, we're smarter than the average church, even though we're a fake church and an imaginary church. We're still better than they are, and have better sense, and aren't going to have people all next to each other, smollicking and LARPing all over each other, and tousling one another's hair, and saying "I love you." No. We will go. We will go momentarily when it goes live. President Obama is speaking in a few moments about the situation with the ongoing civil outcry over the lynching of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery and oh so many others. President Obama will be speaking, and we will take his remarks live from the standpoint of this being a witness to history as it happens. Later on, we will have some religion industry wackadoodle news. And golly Moses, we will also have, we've got a Jim Justice update, and I'm sure you will. You will enjoy the, no, you won't enjoy it at all. It's not enjoyable, but it sure as shit was predictable. Yep. Right now, I'm seeing coverage of, clips of the, announcement by the Minnesota Attorney General, Keith Ellison, announcing the charges against the other three members of the violent thug lynch mob that killed George Floyd. Aiding and abetting second-degree murder. They upgraded the charges against Chauvin to second-degree murder, and the other three got aiding and abetting. Now, is that the same as... Are they liable to have the felony murder rule contained in the second-degree murder statute used against them? I do not know the answer to that. Well, that's true. Brother Deacon Asa says, don't worry about the Cathedral of Common Sense being fake, Bob. All those other churches are fake as fuck, too. True enough. And just so we know, one of the things I have in the Sturm und Drang surrounding Clorox Claudius and his waddle over to St. John's Episcopal Church and his desecration of that sacred ground, and that's not because I buy into any, you know, any mythological beasts like great big giant juvenile delinquent, bearded juvenile delinquents in the sky. St. John's Episcopal Church is sacred ground on a secular basis because, as I noted, Abraham Lincoln was not a Christian in any sense of the word, but he did understand what it meant to the people, and he had some spirituality of his own that he was humble enough not to brute about. And he would go and sit in the back pew there at St. John's from time to time and just ponder and be mindful of the time and the world in which he lived. Not far from St. John's there was the house of William Seward. Was it Seward or Stanton? Seward came from New York and had been Lincoln's Secretary of State. And on the night that Lincoln was killed in April 1865, the gang of violent thugs, recurring theme, attacked Seward as well and tried to kill him. The goal had actually been to take out the entire executive branch. They were going to go after Lincoln, Andrew Johnson, Seward, and try to decapitate the executive branch of the federal government as a means of trying to leverage some sort of settlement with the traitorous Confederate regime. And back in those days, the president could walk from the White House to St. John's Episcopal Church, and no one had to be gassed. What a difference 155 years make. But we also forget that the presidency, the idea of the imperial presidency is still fairly new. Somewhat famously, when Harry Truman was done being president of the United States in January of 1952, Harry Truman, packed up his belongings, he and Bess and their daughter Margaret, and they literally walked out to their car, their personal automobile, got in it, and drove home to Independence, Missouri. No aircraft, no plane, no jets, no helicopters. Of course, I don't think there was a helicopter safe enough for a president to fly in back then. But they just left. And in Truman's case, happily went back to the business of being a private citizen. Now, Truman would go on in the aftermath of the assassination of John Kennedy to step back into the public limelight some 11 years after having left the presidency. He would re-enter the American political sphere, penning an op-ed, I think it was published in the Washington Post, calling for the dissolution and elimination of the Central Intelligence Agency. His plea fell upon deaf ears. But such is history. Now, presidents are, and especially in the aftermath of the Kennedy assassination, presidents have been elevated to a status of something approaching imperial status. Which is part of the evolutionary growth from republic into empire. And while we're still waiting for President Obama to come on, a few notes early on. And thank you. Thank you to our pal Joey. Joey just knocked out half of tomorrow. So that's fantastic. Thank you, Joey. Thank you. Joey with a note saying, Giraffrey wants to have this one read. No, that got read. Well, what the hell, says Joey. I figured that this is a good way to start off prayer meeting Wednesday. So Trump decides to attend church the other day and maybe have a Trump on the stump rally right on the righteous grounds of St. John's Episcopal right across from the White House. Trump's a very religious evangelical, you know, as he decided to cast out all the demons before entering the church grounds. So he had the Secret Service spray the holy incense, tear gas all over the area to make sure the evil spirits were cast out, much like E.W. Jackson would do. And instead of praying for the good people, the protesters for justice, Trump prayed, P-R-E-Y-E-D, upon them. All of a sudden, the president appeared to be praying in tongues, according to Vice President Pence, as Kayleigh McEnany attempted to translate what the mumbling, bumbling moron was saying, which is common when one is praying in the tongues. I guess somebody failed to inform those two dumb shits that the president doesn't pray in tongues or pray in general. It's just the way he talks. Just then, Trump holds up the Bible upside down, much like Joel Osteen does to his congregation, or maybe Adolf Hitler. That photograph has been proven to be a fraud, but nonetheless, it was stirring. For Trump, holding the Bible upside down is quite appropriate because, hell, he's been upside down in every business dealing in his life, from cars to casinos. Wait a minute. This guy hasn't turned a profit in his life. And going to a local church would not turn a profit either. That's the P-R-O-P-H-E-T kind. I don't know why the Bishop Marianne Buddy was so upset by Trump showing up on the church lawn. Hell, Trump's miraculous presence at the church just proves one thing, and that is, yes, there is a God, because by God, Trump is the Antichrist. This has been Joey's Journal for Wednesday, the third day of June, with Giraffery trying, and likely failing, to translate Trump. And then, of course, the following day, he went on a photo op to a shrine of Saint John Paul II. Now, I don't keep up with sainthood proceedings much at all, but I didn't know that old JP2 had been elevated to saintly status. One wonders what sort of miracle he must have done in order to merit it. Hey, let's see. Okay. President Obama is speaking. Let's go now live. Oop, wrong button.
We have seen in the last several weeks, last few months, the kinds of epic changes and events in our country that are as profound as anything that I've seen in my lifetime. And I'm now a lot older than planned. I'm going to be 59 soon. And let me begin by acknowledging that although all of us have been feeling pain, uncertainty, disruption, some folks have been feeling it more than others. Most of all, the pain that's been experienced by the families of George and Brianna and Ahmad and Tony and Sean and too many others to mention, those that we thought about during that moment of silence. And to those families who've been directly affected by tragedy, please know that Michelle and I and the nation grieve with you, hold you in our prayers. We're committed to the fight of creating a more just nation in memory of your sons and daughters. And we can't forget that even as we're confronting the particular acts of violence that led to those losses, our nation and the world is still in the midst of a global pandemic that's exposed the vulnerabilities of our healthcare system, but also the disparate treatment and, as a consequence, the disparate impact that exists in our healthcare system, the unequal investment, the biases that have led to a disproportionate number of infections and loss of life in communities of color. So in a lot of ways, what has happened over the last several weeks is challenges and structural problems here in the United States have been thrown into high relief. they're the outcomes, not just of the immediate moments in time, but they're the result of a long history of slavery and Jim Crow and redlining and institutionalized racism that too often have been the plague, the original sin of our society. And in some ways, as tragic as these past few weeks have been, as difficult and scary and uncertain as they've been, they've also been an incredible opportunity for people to be awakened to some of these underlying trends. And they offer an opportunity for us to all work together to tackle them, to take them on, to change America and make it live up to its highest ideals. And part of what's made me so hopeful is the fact that so many young people have been galvanized and activated and motivated and mobilized. Because historically, so much of the progress that we've made in our society has been because of young people. Dr. King was a young man when he got involved. Cesar Chavez was a young man. Malcolm X was a young man. The leaders of the feminist movement were young people. Leaders of union movements were young people. The leaders of the environmental movement in this country and the movement to make sure that the LGBT community finally had a voice and was represented were young people. And so when sometimes I feel despair, I just see what's happening with young people all across the country and the talent and the voice and the sophistication that they're displaying. And it makes me feel optimistic. It makes me feel as if, you know, this country's going to get better. Now, I want to speak directly to the young men and women of color in this country, who, as Plan just so eloquently described, have witnessed too much violence and too much death. And too often, some of that violence has come from folks who were supposed to be serving and protecting you. I want you to know that you matter. I want you to know that your lives matter, that your dreams matter. And when I go home and I look at the faces of my daughters, Sasha and Malia, and I look at my nephews and nieces, I see limitless potential that deserves to flourish and thrive. And you should be able to learn and make mistakes and live a life of joy without having to worry about what's going to happen when you walk to the store or go for a jog or are driving down the street or looking at some birds in a park. And so I hope that you also feel hopeful, even as you may feel angry, because you have the power to make things better and you have helped to make the entire country feel as if this is something that's got to change. You've communicated a sense of urgency that is as powerful and as transformative as anything that I've seen in recent years. I want to acknowledge the folks in law enforcement that share the goals of reimagining policing, because there are folks out there who took the oath to serve your communities and your countries, had a tough job, and I know you're just as outraged about the tragedies in recent weeks as are many of the protesters. And so we're grateful for the vast majority of you who protect and serve. I've been heartened to see those in law enforcement who've recognized, let me march along with these protesters. Let me stand side by side and recognize that I want to be part of the solution. And who've shown restraint and volunteered and engaged and listened, because you're a vital part of the conversation. And change is going to require everybody's participation. Now, when I was in office, as was mentioned, I created a task force on 21st century policing in the wake of the tragic killing of Michael Brown. That task force, which included law enforcement and community leaders and activists, was charged to develop a very specific set of recommendations to strengthen public trust and foster better working relationships between law enforcement and communities that they're supposed to protect, even as they're continuing to promote effective crime reduction. And that report showcased a range of solutions and strategies that were proven and that were based on data and research to improve community policing and collect better data and reporting and identify and do something about implicit bias in how police were trained and reforms to use the force that police deploy in ways that increase safety rather than precipitate tragedy. And that report demonstrated something that's critical for us today. Most of the reforms that are needed to prevent the type of violence and injustices that we've seen take place at the local level. The reform has to take place in more than 19,000 American municipalities, more than 18,000 local enforcement jurisdictions. And so as activists and everyday citizens raise their voices, we need to be clear about where change is going to happen and how we can bring about that change. It is mayors and county executives that appoint most police chiefs and negotiate collective bargaining agreements with police unions. And that determines police practices in local communities. It's district attorneys and state's attorneys that decide typically whether or not to investigate and ultimately charge those involved in police misconduct. And those are all elected positions. And in some places, they're police community review boards with the power to monitor police conduct. Those oftentimes may be elected as well. The bottom line is, I've been hearing a little bit of chatter in the internet about voting versus protest, politics and participation versus civil disobedience and direct action. This is not a either or. This is a both and. To bring about real change, we both have to highlight a problem and make people in power uncomfortable, but we also have to translate that into practical solutions and laws that can be implemented and we can monitor and make sure we're following up on. So, very quickly, let me just close with a couple of specific things. What can we do? Number one, we know there are specific evidence-based reforms that, if we put in place today, would build trust, save lives, would not show an increase in crime. Those are included in the 21st Century Policing Task Force report. You can find it on Obama.org. Number two, a lot of mayors and local elected officials read and supported the task force report, but then there wasn't enough follow-through. So today I am urging every mayor in this country to review your use of force policies with members of your community and commit to report on planned reforms. What are the specific steps you can take? And I should add, by the way, that the original task force report was done several years ago. Since that time, we've actually collected data, in part because we implemented some of these reform ideas. So we now have more information and more data as to what works. And there are organizations like Campaign Zero and Color of Change and others that are out there highlighting what the data shows, what works, what doesn't in terms of reducing incidents of police misconduct and violence. Let's go ahead and start implementing those. So we need mayors, county executives, others who are in positions of power to say, this is a priority. This is a specific response. Number three, every city in this country should be a My Brother's Keeper community because we have 250 cities, counties, tribal nations who are working to reduce the barriers and expand opportunity for boys and young men of color through programs and policy reforms and public-private partnerships. So go to our website. Get working with that because it can make a difference. And let me just close by saying this. I've heard some people say that you have a pandemic, then you have these protests. This reminds people of the 60s and the chaos and the discord and distrust throughout the country. I have to tell you, although I was very young when you had riots and protests and assassinations and discord back in the 60s, I know enough about that history to say there is something different here. You look at those protests, and that was a far more representative cross-section of America out on the streets, peacefully protesting, and who felt moved to do something because of the injustices that they had seen. That didn't exist back in the 1960s, that kind of broad coalition. The fact that recent surveys have showed that despite some protests having then been marred by the actions of some, a tiny minority that engaged in violence, that despite, you know, as usual, that got a lot of attention, a lot of focus. Despite all that, a majority of Americans still think those protests were justified. That wouldn't have existed 30, 40, 50 years ago. There is a change in mindset that's taking place, a greater recognition that we can do better. And that is not as a consequence of speeches by politicians. That's not the result of, you know, spotlights in news articles. That's a direct result of the activities and organizing and mobilization and engagement of so many young people across the country who put themselves out on the line to make a difference. And so I just have to say thank you to them for helping to bring about this moment and just make sure that we now follow through. Because at some point, you know, attention moves away. At some point, protests start to dwindle in size. And it's very important for us to take the momentum that has been created as a society, as a country, and say, let's use this to finally have an impact. All right. Thank you, everybody. Proud of you guys. I know that we're going to be hearing from a bunch of people who have been on the front lines on this and know a lot more than I do about it. Proud of you.
Thank you, Mr.
And of course, the host was the man get immediately cut off by multimillionaire Joke Toad. I don't know if other outlets are carrying the remainder. Nope. I'd kind of like to have heard what the fella afterwards had to say, but I guess, okay. Here we go. This is Michael Smith of My Brother's Keeper Alliance, the executive director.
Ferguson Uprising, a co-founder of Campaign Zero, a policy platform to end police violence, and co-host of Pod Save the People. Previously, she was an appointed member of the Ferguson Commission and President Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing. Today, Campaign Zero, of which Brittany is a co-founder, launched the campaign #8CantWait. An advocacy campaign to push mayors across America to adopt 8 use of force policies that together can reduce police violence by upwards of 70%. To moderate this conversation with President Obama and our other incredible leaders, please welcome Brittany Packnett Cunningham.
Thank you so much, Michael. And thank you, President Obama, for gathering this conversation in this moment of intense grief, but hopefully intense purpose. We are here together to talk, to have a family conversation. And you may be watching this and have come here because you are experiencing that grief and you need some community in which to do that. And you're hoping that we can hold you up to the light. You may be here because, like me, you are girded in the strength of your ancestry and you know you come from people just like I do, who did far more with far less and are sure that we can win in this moment and everyone after it. However you have come here, why you have come here, we're glad that you're here because we're here to get honest, to get clear, most importantly, to get to work, so that even the heartening moments of seeing people raise their voices, or even in the moments where a police officer might take a knee, that that momentary action might turn into true systemic and lasting change. We have so many brilliant voices that have been gathered. And as we listen to these guests, we'll all be able to better understand how we got to this moment and how we seize our own power to get through it. Before we get started, like Michael, I want to make sure to lift up the names of the people who brought us here, because it wasn't just the former president, though we're deeply grateful. It was George Floyd, a father in Minneapolis. It was Breonna Taylor, a life-saving EMT on the front lines in Louisville. It was Sean Reed, a friend and a brother in Indianapolis. It was Tony McDade, a Black trans man who loved life in Tallahassee, Florida. And though it wasn't from an officer's bullet, we are having this conversation, of course, in the shadow of Ahmaud Arbery, a son from Georgia, and Nina Pop and Ayanna Dior, two Black trans women who were killed by systemic hatred that comes against intersectionally marginalized people in this country every single day. Frankly, there are too many names to list because, as the president has already said, we have been at this, unfortunately, for a long time. So that means that there is indeed work to do, and now we're going to get to do it. So, Attorney General Holder, I actually want to start with you. I was raised always to be an activist. So frankly, if you ask my mom, this is the only life I've ever known. But I came into the work specifically of fighting against the surge of police violence as it relates especially to systemic racism in 2014 when Mike Brown was killed in Ferguson, Missouri, just a few minutes from my own home. And you came to Ferguson. And as you know, there were thousands, literally thousands, of brave and mighty protesters, just like the ones we're seeing outside right now. Those protests and organizers were on the ground, leading for change and making the entire world pay attention. I want to know what you learned from those grassroots activists. What have you carried from those conversations in Ferguson with you through to the work that you did then and that you're doing now?
Yeah, well, it's good to see you again. And thank you, President Obama, for convening us here today. You know, I remember back in 2014, I remember meeting with the president. We were on vacation and talking about whether or not I should go to Ferguson. It was a risky thing. Didn't know exactly how people would react to my presence, but we made the determination that I would go. And I think the thing that struck me the most was there were a few things that really got me. I mean, there were young people who were there and who were unbelievably impressive, who were in a lot of ways directing the actions that you saw on the streets. You saw a community that was in anguish, and there was a commonality with regard to the things that they were concerned about. I was really struck by the fact that people consistently talked about the way in which people of color were unfairly treated by the criminal justice system. And there was a genuine desire by people to make things better. It wasn't all about just complaining. There was a genuine desire to work, to make things better. And I left there actually heartened by what I saw, both in terms of the reaction that I got. People were extremely respectful, and I thought we had good dialogues while I was there. But I also left with the notion that if we invested some time, if we invested some federal resources, that we would be in a position, using the great leaders that we met there, those young people who we met there, to make life in Ferguson better, and then use that as an example of what was possible in the rest of the country.
So, as the president reminded us, this is not about an either-or question, right? One of my favorite things to remind people, as President Obama has already done, is that this is not about policy or protest. This is about policy and protest. And that we know, as Dr. King and so many others throughout history taught us, is that protest is actually what creates the pressure so that the policy can get passed. Similarly, we are in a long-term game and a short-term game here, that while we are dealing with radical imagination and reimagining what public safety can look like, even beyond police in our communities, we also have to make sure that people are safe now. In your role as Attorney General, you did a lot of that work in addressing people's safety right now. So can you tell us what you learned that was instructive for this moment, particularly as you engaged in pattern and practice investigations and consent decrees, once if situations like this happened in communities and once we saw the kind of uprisings that we did all over the country when you were still in office?
Well, I think one of the key things that people have to understand is that there's not a tension between justice and having fair treatment and public safety. You can keep people safe and also have a better, more equitable criminal justice system. I mean, you know, I'm not going to get too boastful here, but, you know, for the first time in 40 years during the Obama administration, we reduced the number of people who were incarcerated in the federal system and also lowered the crime rate. Again, there is not that tension. You can make things better in terms of community and police relationships and keep people safe at the same time. And so what we tried to do was come up with ways in which we could look at what we thought were the problems in the criminal justice system and with regard to how policing was done, address those, involve the community in those efforts, engage law enforcement in those efforts, bring them together in forums so that they could get to know each other, understand how difficult it is to be a police officer, understand how communities of color have had to deal with unfair law enforcement practices over the years. You know, bring people together. And it was through that, through those kinds of meetings that we were able to formulate the policies that ultimately led to the 21st century proposals. And then the other things that we did, you know, bringing pattern and practice in investigations, using the power that we had under the civil rights statutes that we were able to enforce. You know, it was for me the highlight of my time as Attorney General. It was to given the opportunity to get into communities to affect positive change, to bring and establish relationships between, again, people in law enforcement, people in communities of color. That was, I think, in some ways, you know, what I'm most proud of. And it laid, I think, the foundation for future work. But I would always emphasize this, you know, that young people, you know, that's our audience here today. Young people were critically involved in all of the work that we did, starting at Ferguson and other parts of the country.
I want to ask you one more question before I move on to our next speaker. You know, at Campaign Zero, we believe we can live in a world where the police don't kill people. So many of us are really trying to engage, rattle imagination to imagine what our communities look like. Like I said, even beyond police, even looking at a moment where we don't even have traditional systems because our communities are so healthy from the ground up. When you think about your most radical dream for what is possible, your most radical imagination for where we can get to as a community and as a people, what is that dream?
Ooh, that's an interesting one. You know, I guess my dream is that we would get to a place where people are judged on their individual deeds, the individual characteristics, and that we don't stereotype people. And that, you know, is not only with regard to how we do things in the criminal justice system. I think we make a mistake if we think that the criminal justice system exists separate and apart from the greater society. The issues that we face in the criminal justice system, inappropriate uses of force, implicit bias, whole range of things, those grow out of the same kinds of problems that we see in the larger society. And so we've got to deal with problems, you know, that more systemically, more society-wide, if we want to actually deal and be effective in bringing about needed change with regard to the criminal justice system. So, you know, I would hope that we get to a place where, you know, discrimination is no longer a factor in the lives of people of color. That fair treatment would be something that would be expected. That stereotypes, you know, born in slavery, and the notion that, you know, in order to enslave a people, you had to think that they were in some ways different, some ways inferior. And those attitudes may not be as explicit as they once were, but still are a part, I think, of the American psyche implicitly. And radical change, I'd like to, you know, erase those feelings and base policy on, you know, on real world experiences, on the reality of the people of this nation, as opposed to the perceptions of them, the stereotypes of them.
What I hear you is saying is that being able to live, being able to breathe, not having anyone's foot on your neck is not actually a radical idea at all, that it is what everybody is owed. Thank you so much, Attorney General Holder, for joining us. I want to move now to Philippe Cunningham, who is a councilman from the city of Minneapolis, where so much of this is centered. Minneapolis is really ground zero in so many ways, as it was home to George Floyd and his family. Philippe, I have so many questions for you, but first, I want to know how you're doing and what is happening on the ground in Minneapolis. You know, I see here on the Zoom call my friend Deion Jones, who was peacefully protesting in Los Angeles when he was hit with the rubber bullet. We've seen so many images of that kind of unnecessary confrontation, and a lot of them, unfortunately, are coming from Minneapolis. So how is home? How is the home team doing? And what do we outside of Minneapolis need to understand about what's going on the ground?
Yes, well, thank you so much for having me. Thank you for that question. I too just want to start off with naming that I'm here today because of the strength of my ancestors and elders who came before me fighting the fight to make my existence and work as an elected official possible. So on the ground in Minneapolis, folks are mobilizing on a scale we've never seen before, and a diverse coalition, a very diverse coalition of folks is emerging demanding justice. Not only for George Floyd, but justice in how the city of Minneapolis protects its residents. What we are seeing right now from folks on the ground in Minneapolis and across the country is generations of trauma and rage at the violence bestowed on the Black community and the disinvestment of the Black community by the state at every single level of government. And I'll just add that I myself, as a Black queer transgender man, I too live firsthand both the trauma and the trauma that I have to carry around experiencing the witnessing state-sanctioned violence, as well as the generational trauma of my ancestors who survived slavery. So seeing all of this, layering it on, what's interesting about the fact that all of this has really been ground zero in Minneapolis is that we are an incredibly progressive city. At the same time, we are also the city that has the most significant racial disparities between white and Black folks in the entire country across every indicator of quality of life. So this has just been boiling under the surface. I've been in office now for 2.5 years. And within my first 2 years, I had to deal with 3 officer-involved shooting deaths in my ward alone, including one that was a suicide by cop. The trauma from those incidents doesn't just dissipate because the legal system deems their deaths justified. The evidence is clear overall. President Obama spoke to the data that we're starting to see. Over-policing, criminalization, and mass incarceration have not kept our communities safer. In fact, people getting caught in the criminal justice system further disenfranchises Black and Brown folks, pushing us further to the margins of society due to criminal histories, thus triggering a cycle of involvement with crime in the criminal justice system that is often passed intergenerationally. So what we're seeing on the ground in Minneapolis is folks saying enough is enough. And our system is obviously broken. And it's time for a new system of public safety in our city. Over the years, we have heard from folks who believe that the solution is simply adding more police officers. And we've also heard from folks who are reformers who want to advocate for incremental change. But even those voices right now are waning because our whole city has seen for the past 3 nights that we have the ability to keep ourselves safe and our communities safe. So you ask how I'm doing, I'll say I'm a little bit tired because I've been up all night with my community, organizing my community very closely with folks on the ground to post up patrol because Minneapolis Police Department nor the National Guard were showing up to protect our homes and our small businesses. We're seeing large-scale protests. What folks are seeing on the media right now, the protests and riots in South Minneapolis, we see that. But in North Minneapolis, the historically Black community in Minneapolis, where I represent, we've been dealing with far right-wing and white supremacist groups terrorizing our community by burning down Black-owned businesses. So we've come together protected our own community, and now it's time for us to systematize community-led safety strategies and make them sustainable.
There's so much that you said, and couldn't agree with you more on all of it. I want to hold space for the intersections of your identities and the ways that systems particularly impact you and other folks in your community, because that's such a critical part of the conversation, and we cannot allow it to be erased. Secondly, I want to acknowledge and agree with everything that you said about the fact that we save us, and we can continue to save us, that we can actually, as I've been saying, imagine this beyond our traditional systems and figure out how we protect one another and how we build up strong communities from the ground up, because we are more than capable no matter what anyone else says. So that's actually what I really want to ask you about, because as an elected official, you are playing a role in a traditional system, but you're also having radical imagination about what's possible. We know that budgets are moral documents, and we know that as we see some cities investing more in policing, they are divesting from housing and jobs and the things that keep people well and keep their needs met. So how are you thinking about the demands that are coming directly from grassroots activists and enacting the most imaginative and bold, even though, as we said earlier, they should just be the things that people receive? How are you thinking about enacting those things, and where does Minneapolis have to go to ensure that everybody there is not just living in a liberal city, but that they're living in an equitable city?
That's right. Thank you for framing it that way. So when I talk about the work that needs to be done, what we have seen is that a lot of reform efforts that have been implemented, we had tremendous leadership from our former mayor, Minneapolis Mayor Betsy Hodges, who came into office unabashedly demanding major overhauls in the police, Minneapolis Police Department. She appointed the first woman chief, police chief, who is also Native, and the first out LGBT police chief. Every officer was trained in procedural justice and anti-bias training. A community engagement team was created. Then she appointed our city's first Black police chief, Chief Arredondo, whose vision for what's possible for policing is inspiring and what we would all like to see for policing. But even with all of that work, many officers have been in all but open revolt against these efforts, with their grievances being aired by the Police Federation. So when we take a step back and look at the big picture about what does it mean to keep our community safe, we have to be thinking about it from a different frame, a different paradigm. We know that the system of policing is rooted, it's founded on and rooted in white supremacy and a history of slave catching.
Ding.
And so as we're trying to do this work of reforming police culture and the institution of policing overall, we have to get serious about investing in new alternative systems of public safety that are rooted in justice and our community. We have a paradigm for this. It's the public health approach to public safety. So thinking about violence as a disease that spreads, as a contagious disease, it spreads interpersonally and it spreads intergenerationally. And so there are evidence-based strategies. We in Minneapolis have been working very closely with John Jay College, as well as their National Network for Safe Communities, as well as Cities United. We've all been working together to really institutionalize this opportunity. I have been a tireless advocate for violence prevention and intervention efforts. We created, in late 2018, the Office of Violence Prevention through city ordinance. So now it can't be taken away. We institutionalized a new system. But that only goes so far. We need money to go into that. And that's where the budget as a moral document comes in. There's always political will to put more money into the police budget. The police budget in Minneapolis is almost $200 million. And we have right now, we approved last year a budget of $1.6 billion. They take up a huge chunk. I had to fight relentlessly to get $50,000 for a domestic violence intervention program strategy for us to implement, despite the fact that in Minneapolis, the number one reason for 911-initiated police calls for service is because of domestic assault. We are not successfully getting to the roots of these issues. So having a systemic, institutionalized, new approach to public safety that is community led, that invests in community with the prevention and intervention, as well as thinking big, even moving further upstream, thinking about housing, jobs, employment, training, education, thinking about all of that. That is what true comprehensive public safety is. And we have to start thinking about what does it look like to have a future without police? What would it look like for us to not need police and then work backwards from there?
I used to be a teacher, so backwards planning from everything that is possible is my jam. That's my favorite thing to do. And I'm so glad that you really helped root us in the concept of, again, radical imagination and then action toward that. So obviously there are things that have to happen in the short term. There are policies that have to change. There are investments that have to be made as you move toward those long-term goals. But I really want to, as I close with you, ask you, what should we all be understanding, those of us who do not live in Minneapolis, about what the grassroots demands are as we are making our voices heard and attempting to be supportive of what is happening on the ground there? What should we be lifting up in the short term, the long term, and everything in between to get to that place of, as you said, comprehensive community safety that has to include not just policy, but culture and investment?
That's right. Well, first I'll just say I too was a teacher. I was a special education teacher on the south side of Chicago. So the backwards planning is a good thing, right? So what we really need in terms of support in Minneapolis is we just need for folks to keep an eye on us and to be able to hold us accountable, because there is some real momentum here. We, like I said, we've heard, since I've been in office, I have heard from so many folks who are just like, the way we solve this problem is by just adding more police. If we just add more police, that will solve the problem. Or if we implement these specific reforms, body cams, diversifying the police department, anti-bias training, those sort of reforms, then we'll see the outcomes. But we really need to dig even deeper into it. And what we're seeing is a groundswell of demands for the city of Minneapolis to defund the police. That's what we're seeing right now. These folks are the ones who are transformation oriented. And so in Minneapolis, the public and political will right now are very concentrated at this point in transformational change. And things have also changed in that who is in elected office here. I'm actually not the only Black trans person on Minneapolis City Council. A lot of folks don't realize that. My sister, Council Vice President Andrea Jenkins, is also on the Minneapolis City Council. And she is a powerhouse. Activists and organizers have allies with the same vision for equity and justice who are in office now. So that really opens the possibility when we all work together. So I would say that we're starting to dive into it. The state's Minnesota Department of Human Rights has opened an investigation into the police department for the last 10 years for systemic racial discrimination. So I would say what we need right now is for folks outside of Minneapolis to keep an eye on what's going on, and also to invest in the folks, the organizations who are on the ground, who have been doing this work for years and years, and to also push folks on the ground here, communities, to make their voices heard. That is one of the biggest things, is that I hear the most from the folks who just simply want more police. I have been labeled soft on crime because of the fact that I advocate for a comprehensive approach to public safety. So we need folks who believe in transformational change and what community safety can look like and how to get there. We need for folks' voices to be heard.
We've already begun to see the seeds of so much of that transformation right there in your hometown due to leadership of yours and so many others. We saw the first Black woman student body president at the University of Minnesota get them to stop contracting with the police force there. We saw that the public schools there followed suit. And from former teacher to former teacher, I'm always like, yes, it's about time that we actually make schools safe for all young people. And that doesn't need to include police. So thank you so much. not just for this conversation, but for your continued courage and action in the role that you're playing. I'm going to come lastly to my good friend and partner in this work, Rashad Robinson, who is the president of Color of Change. Rashad, we've been on the phone a lot in the last few weeks, and you are always thinking so critically about how we ensure that the local conversations that Councilman Cunningham just talked about are really upheld at the national level and that everyone is doing their part. As I always say, we don't have saviors, we build teams, and that's how we get the work done in community. And that's exactly the work that Color of Change does. It gives all of us an opportunity to be on the team. So how are you thinking about making sure that people understand what their role is on the team? What are the spectrum of demands that you are seeing coming from your members at Color of Change and that you all are exploring and pushing as you do this work?
Well, thank you. First of all, thank you, Brittany, for that question. Thank you, President Obama and Attorney General Holder. And it's actually great to be on this conversation and to be back doing work with my brother's keeper. What I will say is a couple of things. You know, over the last 8 months just alone, over 5 million people have taken action with Color of Change, raising their voices online, signing petitions, making phone calls, showing up to rallies. And that's important, right? Because what we want to be able to do is translate the presence of this moment into the ability to actually change the rules. And sometimes those are the written rules of policy, and other times those are the written, unwritten rules of culture. And I want to talk about both, about why both of those things are critically important in this moment and why we have to channel strategic action to actually get things done. No individual alone is going to work to change systemic racism in all the ways that it impacts our society. Racism is like water pouring over a floor with holes in it. It will find the cracks. And so we constantly need to figure out how are we shoring up the systems that will have cracks in them and building new systems for the future. And so on the written rule side, we are very much focused on how do you give people in that moment something clear to do, pushing for justice when justice needs to be served, but working, recognizing that we've got to move people up a ladder of engagement, because none of the families simply want justice for their own family. They recognize that the long-term rules need to change. And when it comes to policing, there is so much that happens at the local level that we have to pay attention to. The other speakers talked about it. And so we need to be focusing that energy on local policy, pushing to change local practice. And the difference between policy and practice is sometimes we change the laws, but we also have to change the people who implement those laws. And then we think about the work at the federal level. And we've got to change all of the ways in which money from the federal level incentivizes and disincentivizes certain types of action. And part of what we try to do at Color of Change is point people at those strategic things to do, building sort of the energy and helping to describe for people how to do it. You know, a couple of years ago, in the height of the work to, you know, challenge police violence, we came up against district attorneys and state's attorneys that we simply did not have the ability to move. We would show up. It didn't matter if we had 10 petitions or 10,000 petitions or 100,000 petitions. They were not nervous about disappointing our community. And so we recognized we had to help the community better understand the role of district attorneys. We had to build more energy because district attorneys could operate without public pressure. These are executive level positions that can have a large amount, the sort of most powerful actors in the criminal justice space. So we built the only searchable national database of prosecutors in the country called winningjustice.org. We worked with folks in Hollywood like Common to develop an animated video that describes the role of district attorneys for everyday people so people can understand how district attorneys operate. We worked across the movement to get folks from big organizations to local grassroots organizations aligned around 6 clear demands that we could take to get people talking about treating kids as kids, reducing and ending the use of money bail, increasing transparency. All of these things are critically important to sort of winning justice long term, right? We have to change the role of prosecutors, and we have to change what the public expects from prosecutors. We have to change the way that the public thinks about criminal justice. And that kind of leads me to the cultural conversation. Because for the last 20 years, basically, kind of with a couple of blips here and there, violent crime has steadily went down in our country. But according to Pew and everyone else, Americans think that violent crime is going up. And so we have a deep gap between perception and reality. And that makes it much harder when we are trying to do those critical things that the councilman talked about in terms of reducing police budgets, in terms of actually ensuring that we're investing in education and mental health and jobs and all the things that we know that communities that have reduced the need for law enforcement, they don't need as many police. And so because the public has been inundated with images that makes us believe that violent crime is right around the window, right around the door, we've had to build a program. And through our work at changehollywood.org, through our efforts, we worked with USC to do a whole study of crime TV shows. And now we're working in writers' rooms to push and change the content and the storytelling. One of the things that we looked at was all of these crime TV shows that are covered in cities like Chicago and New York, very diverse on air. And then you look at the writers' rooms, and all the writers' rooms are all white, folks with no sort of connection to the community, no skin in the game on sort of the impact of the images that they're portraying, constantly putting sort of black faces on the criminal justice system, a sort of magical world where black and brown people exist, but racism doesn't. And we have to really work to sort of change that. And part of that activism is the work that we have to do, because if we're going to get to the place where the narrative changes enough for us to achieve the type of policy changes that are needed, we have to change the story. And I want to say that far too often we tell a story about black communities being vulnerable. And we'll say things like black communities are vulnerable when black communities have been under attack. Black communities have been targeted. Black communities have had a history of being fleeced, of being underinvested. And all of those things are not about being vulnerable. Those are things about being on the chopping block. And so when we work to change that story, we can accomplish so much more.
I have one very brief question for you, because I know we have to wrap up now. People keep asking me this question, so I want to ask you, and maybe you can give me some tips. Is this moment a game changer? We've been in this work for a while now. Many people have been in it for even longer than us. But is this moment a seismic shift in what's possible, where we see ourselves right now?
You know, I think it's a great question, because I think that we want fast food. We want things that are quick, and we want things that are easy. And progress and justice is not easy, right? The thing about inflection points is that they present the possibility for huge leaps forward, or they actually present the real threat for us to go backwards. And I think what we all have to recognize is that a lot of things actually have changed over the last several years. White people in a Starbucks take out their cell phone and are filming a police interaction that they don't actually, that they recognize is wrong, because a movement has built the sort of mental model to train them. A major financial company, when they create consequences for an employee that does something racist in a park, uses the word racism in their statement in a way that we probably wouldn't have imagined them doing. That doesn't mean we give institutions too much credit, but we recognize what we have won along the way and the way in which we have shifted what our demands can be. We've shifted what can be possible. And so I want folks to think that we have been the game changer. The game has continued to change. And the deep level of pushback that we can continue to get from forces is an absolute result of the power that our movement is building. Make no mistake, it doesn't mean that progress is a straight line. But I want folks who are coming into this movement to not come into this movement thinking that they've got to fix a movement, but that they've got to, like, put on their armor and join us. They've got to follow the institutions that have been driving and making so much change. And then they've got to add their creativity and their interest to what we are doing. But we have been winning. And so much of the reaction to what we are seeing is a result of the progress that I believe we are making.
Precisely. The pushback wouldn't be so great if the progress wasn't real. We are the game changer. Rashad, thank you so much. You know, we've heard in this conversation that social change work, changing our communities, having the kind of world we deserve, it's hard work, but it is absolutely necessary work. And we have to be brave enough to imagine what is possible and then go work for it and not just dream it. And we also have to be incisive enough to make sure that people are safe and whole and healthy now. Look, Black people deserve to live because we are human, and Black people deserve much more from America for lots of reasons, but in part because we often save it from itself. We know for sure that we don't just deserve to survive, we deserve to thrive. That means we need justice. And as Dr. Cornel West says, justice is what love looks like in public. So let's go make sure that love is living out loud in public. Mr. President, I see your face. I've seen that face many times before in our meetings. I know you are itching to ask a question. So I will close and hand it off to you.
Well, listen, I've just been enjoying you know, hearing all the wisdom that's been spread by so many others. I want to first of all give Eric Holder his props as Attorney General. He rebuilt a civil rights division within the Justice Department and was consistently on the ground working with communities, listening to communities, and coming up with practical solutions to try to make things better. And I couldn't be prouder of him. Blown away by Philippe and all the good work that he's doing. Rashad has been a consistent warrior for change. You know, he was part of the conversations we had after Ferguson. Brittany, you know, I think you're all that. So as I listen, I am feeling once again inspired. And what has particularly inspired me is the degree to which folks are thinking strategically, practically, at a very detailed level about where are the places where you can make change and what are the practical solutions, backed up by research, backed up by data, backed up by experience, that allows us to create a set of communities that are safe and just, safe and fair, safe and non-discriminatory. And that is possible. And I think that one of the things that has been raised is the fact that we don't have the capacity to eradicate 400 years of racism in one fell swoop. So if we think that this is a seismic shift, I hope people don't feel like, well, nothing's going to happen once we figure this out. As I've been known to quote Dr. King, I've said frequently, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. We bend it. All of you have bent it over the last 4, 5, 6, 10 years, and we are seeing the fruits of those labors in the degree of awareness that is out there. Look, think about some of the people who have unequivocally spoken out against what happened in Minneapolis. I mean, you have I just saw Jim Harbaugh. I know we got the Ohio State contingent here, but you got Jim Harbaugh, the coach of Michigan football, marching today. That's not something that was happening 5, 6 years ago. Although Jim, I know, and he's been on the right side of this issue for quite some time. You have unlikely participants because all of you have worked so hard to raise awareness. That's the progress that has been made. It doesn't mean everything's been solved. The only question I think maybe might be worthwhile for me to throw out there, even though I've read enough of the literature to have a pretty good sense of what the answer is going to be. Brittany, you mentioned that Campaign Zero has put forward 8 Can't Wait. We've talked about the 21st Century Task Force report. It'd be useful maybe to just tick off very quickly. What are the 8 things that are the 8 that Campaign Zero is promoting? Because for a lot of people who are watching, they may be surprised that some of these things are practical and could be implemented quickly. I know just one off the top of my head that I know we can all focus on because it's been so painfully real these last few weeks. Chokeholds and strangleholds. Just saying that's not what we do. You don't need that in order to effectively restrain someone. So give me what are they in executive summary form so people can hear what these specific things are.
Got you. So I didn't know the first question would come to me, but the 8 things are banning chokeholds and strangleholds, requiring de-escalation first, requiring a warning before pulling out a weapon, exhausting all alternatives for those actions. A duty of other officers to intervene, so officers can't just stand there and watch injustice happen. Banning shooting at moving vehicles, we know that keeps police and everyday citizens safe. Establishing a use of force and requiring all force to be reported. And I want to be really clear. Together, those 8 things can reduce police violence by upwards of 70%. That does not stand in competition with what Philippe just walked us through. Because we know that these things can happen immediately without any executive order or act of Congress, all we need is a mayor to have the political will and courage to stand up and say, those 8 can't wait, and I will go and change the use of the force standard tonight, let alone tomorrow. So do that now, and then continue to work with your community, because we will continue to keep up the pressure, I can promise you that, to make sure that we are getting to those comprehensive public safety solutions that are community-based and community-oriented and far beyond anything that we're experiencing right now that Philippe just walked us through. These don't stand in competition with imagination. These are a necessary step immediately to keep people safe as we do the hard work of making sure we get to what's possible.
That's great. And let me just point out, in my opening remarks, I mentioned sometimes this tension is posed between political participation and protest. Philippe's an example of why you have to participate politically, because if you are on the streets protesting and making demands, having somebody on the city council who can follow up and respond and advocate and deal with pushback and is in the room when budgets are made and is advising mayors on how they're going to negotiate the next collective bargaining contract with the police union. You need those folks in order to ultimately deliver the goods. I'm constantly mindful of the fact that this is not an either-or thing, and there's so many ways, all of which are necessary to make a difference. When Rashad talked about the cultural element of this, Dr. King, this may be apocryphal, but I think somebody mentioned to him, just having an anti-discrimination bill, an anti-lynching bill, that's not going to change hearts and minds. He says, no, it won't, but it'll maybe stop me from getting lynched. And that's important, too. Now, so laws are important. On the other hand, the narrative and the stories and telling people, here, see me, I'm human, here's my pain. This is somebody's son, this is somebody's uncle. Here's the story that you need to understand about our background and our community. how do we break down stereotypes, as Eric Holder eloquently talked about? That's the work of a lot of people. You know, so some are going to be on the streets protesting. Some are going to be running for office. Some are going to be writing. During this week, I picked up and reread The Fire Next Time. It is frightening to notice how James Baldwin can lay out a reality 50 years ago that sounds like it was written yesterday. And that's activism. That's work. That's participation. So I worry sometimes that, you know, as we debate strategies, people start thinking there's one way of doing things. We all have a role to play. We all have a part. The more specific we are, practical, you know, in the short term, as well as visionary in the long term, the better off we're going to be. But with that, I'm going to be quiet because you don't need to hear from more old head stuff. But I just want to say how much I appreciate all of you. And Michael, I'm assuming that the conversation is going to continue.
Yes, sir. Let me go ahead and jump in and thank Brittany for the masterful moderation and for all the wisdom and hard work that was on display. I'm now going to turn it over to our Deputy Director for Network and Partnerships at My Brother's Keeper Alliance, Nicole Fields, who's going to take a couple questions from our MBK communities. So not everyone watching has an opportunity to ask questions, but our MBK communities do. So that's another reason you should become an MBK community. So Nicole is going to pose a couple questions, but we will get you out of here by 6:30, everyone. We realize that we've been on for a while, but we will be sending resources afterwards. We've also created a Google group so we can continue this conversation there as well. So Nicole, let me bring you on to field those questions.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Brittany. Thank you, President Obama. Really powerful conversation. Tons of great questions. As Michael mentioned, we can continue this conversation. So if we don't get to your question, do not worry. We can continue this conversation in our Google group. I'm going to take the first question from our young people. Playon Patrick asks, this question is directed at Councilman Cunningham. How have the media's portrayal of frequent violent riots in Minneapolis affected your efforts to promote the work of protesters, activists, and elected officials pushing towards a self-sustaining public safety system?
Yes, thank you for that question, Playon. So the media's portrayal of hyper-focusing on the violent protests or the violence and the rioting happening during the protest really pulls away from what is actually happening. The real story of the trauma and the pain and the reason why folks are out on the ground doing the work, why we are traumatized as a community, why we are doing this work together. So the media is looking for a sensational story, and talking about the public health approach to public safety is not that sexy. So it's easier to be able to pick the what's happening right now, make that newsworthy. And so what it does is it's distracting. It's distracting from the voice of the folks who are on the community, who have demands, who have a clear vision. It's distracting. It's pulling away from their voice and centering them. The folks who have been on the ground nonstop for years, some folks in their cases for decades. And so I want to make sure that I've been all over the media. I've been fortunate that folks have been reaching out all over the world, and I keep hammering home. Everybody wants to talk about the riots and, you know, the violence and you know, everything that's happening, but I always redirect it back to it is possible for us to build alternative systems to public safety outside of policing. It requires political will, it requires investment, and we are already doing it and it works. And so trying to constantly bring it back to that is really what I think it's important that we have messengers who have the platforms, the bully pulpits, as we say in politics, have those platforms to be able to speak that. We have to keep pushing it and not let media distract us from really the point, which is justice.
Thank you, Councilmember.
Great. Well said. The next question actually was asked, a few folks asked the same exact question, and I think any one of our panelists can take this. What advice can you give to mayors to honor protesters' demands for more police accountability and less brutal and racist practices while supporting their police force and maintaining broad public confidence? Folks have been asking, how do we change these accountability measures while also confronting police unions who have invested in our elected officials?
You know, I'm going to take a stab at something just because I think it's illustrative. It doesn't answer the entire question. When I was in the state legislature back in Illinois, we passed one of the first, if not the first, laws dealing with racial profiling in traffic stops. And there was no way to get that passed without support of the FOP, the Fraternal Order of Police, the primary organization of the police unions. And the argument I was able to make to them was that police officers are going to be safer if there is greater trust and less tension, that they will be able to do their jobs better if they have data that has been collected that is clear, and police chiefs are going to be able to manage their forces more effectively. They will be less distracted by things that don't require an armed response, and they can refocus attention in ways that are good for them as well as the community. And it took a long time to make that argument, and I'm sure that there are rank and file members who didn't believe it. But in fact, after we passed it, we started being able to collect data on that issue, and we were able to get them to go along. Now, how responsive the police union is going to be in any circumstance, you know, it's going to go city by city. And it's not easy. But I guess the point I am making, and Eric Holder, if he's still on, may want to chime in on this. I do think there is police leadership that recognizes the need for change. But changing culture is hard. And sometimes the dynamics within the unions themselves are difficult. And, you know, and sometimes there's that sense of we need to close ranks even though we know some things are messed up. And so finding ways to listen and recognize that they have a tough job, but also then insist that this is what we need to do. We're going to do it. We'll work with you to figure out how to do it. So when Brittany talked about the eight can't wait, you should have a dialogue to find out what specific things are a problem with not having to choke somebody, particularly when they're already in handcuffs. What is it that you think is a problem? When you force people to articulate what it is that they object to with reasonable demands of the sort that have been outlined, a lot of times they come up empty. But you have to engage in that conversation. And I think that it's possible to get that done. At the end of the day, though, if you don't have the political pressure to do it, they will resist. Just because the status quo always resists without some pressure. And that's why it's so important, both for the protests and for the follow-up that people like Councilman Cunningham can apply.
Great. Thank you, President Obama. Next question. I'm going to take two more. This question is coming from Dr. Jim Bostic in Yonkers, New York. First, he thanks our panelists and says his question is, how do we effectively integrate the generational differences in age and history often see develop between our younger generation and those of us who have been in this fight for many decades in such a way that we respect each other's ideas and approaches to dealing with institutional racism in our respective communities and not diminish the role and the will of either?
So I'm going to say I'm going to have to call it here. This will have to be the last question. And I'm going to ask one of our panelists to take that and try to give us a 90-second response. While you're thinking of your response, I just want to say how grateful we are for Dr. Jim Bostic. Yonkers is one of our MBK Impact communities that is doing extraordinary work on the ground in Yonkers and in the prison system in Yonkers as well. So who'd like to take that question with a quick response?
Well, I'd say this. There is the need for young people to work with people like myself who have some years behind them. And the arrogance of youth cannot be the determinant. The arrogance of age can't be a determinant. There is wisdom through lived experience. There's idealism that young people possess in abundance. And it's a combination of that idealism with that experience that I think makes the most effective movements. People who are older have to understand that young people have always been at the forefront of positive change in this nation. I mean, the founding fathers were really young people. The oldest Federalist was George Washington. He was only 44 years old. Richard Pryor used to say that you don't see many old fools. And so I think young people need to understand that as well. You don't get to be 60, 70, 80 years old without having navigated a whole series of things that's worthwhile. And you have things as a young person you might want to test, theories you want to try. Older people can say, well, I've experienced this, and this is why this theory is not going to work. So it is a combination of the two. And a lack of arrogance on the part of both that ultimately can create a coalition that can be successful.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Mr. President, before we wrap up, any final words?
No, keep working and stay hopeful. As I said, this is a moment, and we've had moments like this before where people are paying attention. That doesn't mean that everything will get solved. And so don't get disheartened, because there's a marathon, not a sprint. But the fact that people are paying attention provides an opportunity to educate, activate, mobilize, and act. And I hope that we are able to seize this moment. I hope the mayors across the country who have either been watching or hear about this, take that pledge to start immediately implementing some steps that can make a difference. And I hope all the young people who've been inspired and engaged and involved, they keep at it, because that's what ultimately is going to create the kind of country we want. And for those who have been talking about protests, just remember, this country was founded on protest. It is called the American Revolution. And every step of progress in this country, every expansion of freedom, every expression of our deepest ideals has been won through efforts that made the status quo uncomfortable. And we should all be thankful for folks who are willing in a peaceful, disciplined way to be out there making a difference. So thank you so much, everybody. Proud of you.
Thank you, Mr. President. I encourage all of you to go to Obama.org. Go to Obama.org. If you're a mayor, take the pledge. If you're looking to become an MBK community, if you're looking for places to donate or resources, or just to join the alliance, go to Obama.org. We will continue to be there for you, with you. Our partners at the Leadership Conference, mayors, are excited to provide technical assistance for you as you think about reading those use of force policies, as well as our broader partner network. So This is just the beginning of a conversation. We'll continue this in many different ways, and also be on the lookout for our next town hall that will be coming up, as well as some other actions. Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Thank you, Councilman Cunningham. Thank you, Brittany. Thank you, Rashad Robinson. Thank you to all of our MBK communities for the extraordinary work you do every day on behalf.
I think that was about an hour and 15 minutes. Very well spent. And anytime we get an opportunity to hear from President Obama, we are reminded, and I how can he not know this? That what a vast gulf there is between his ability to reason through a concept and a sentence and the current occupant's hopeless inability. Earlier when President Obama began speaking, I got a note from Lee in New York titled Obligatory Star Trek Reference. Lee said, I miss hearing from President Obama, a proud graduate of the Shatner's School of Speech. And I know exactly what he's talking about because I'm guilty of it myself sometimes, that we come in peace sort of thing. The difference being was that Shatner was putting that on as an element of his stagecraft in attempting to make Captain Kirk sound like a thoughtful person. Whereas when Barack Obama is not working from a script, it is him using his formidable intellect to make sure that he says precisely what he means to say in the living moment. In the living moment. God bless America. So, one of the things, because of, you know, the little characters that live in the back of my mind, I know that somewhere out there, not necessarily in the Horn Family Community Congregation, but somebody who tuned in, or a lot of somebodies who tuned into that, you know, members of the Sparkle Fart Propelled Unicorn Cavalry Purity Patrol were muttering, goddamn establishment neoliberal shill. And it just strikes me, it's a little bit, in my case, it's a little bit of setting up a straw man, and I apologize for that. But I know it. I know it all the way down to my toenails. I see it all the time. And it is a classic case of that long established admonition that one not let the perfect be the enemy of the good. How many things were left undone by President Obama? How many things were left unaddressed? I know, for my part, several. But good things were also accomplished. They were not as good as many of us would like to have had. Many of us saw him go away at the end of his second term, and we didn't have a fucking pony anymore. Damn it. We were supposed to get a pony. And I've sat through meetings that sounded like that. I recognize some of the speech patterns, and they are not specific to an ethnicity or they are generated by groups based on prior experience. And I couldn't help myself as I listened, but to note that probably everybody there was knocking down a salary north of six figures. And that will always be the hobgoblin of activism. It just is. People who watched that film that Michael Moore executive produced, Planet of the Humans, I watched it and was not particularly impressed. I was impressed by the fact that it called out some people who desperately needed to be called out, but it also presented the case of we're just fucked, oh well, die. And I can never be that kind of a nihilist. So it all sort of, there's good and bad in all things. Dr. Bill, when he closed his program today and I jumped in right at the end, he said, well, maybe by next week we can get back to talking about things that happened in the 18th century. And I jumped in and I said, Dr. Bill, everything we're talking about right now is because of things that happened in the 18th century. And a man of great good humor and conviviality and collegiality that Dr. Bill is, he said, well, you're absolutely right about that. Because that's what history does. It midwifes the present. Well, I see Stan the Studio Stinkbug has made an appearance. Yuck. Hey, thank you to Jeremy. Jeremy jumped in alongside Joey. And so we're more than halfway done with tomorrow, and that's fantastic. Magnificent. Second Star Trek reference, this coming from Darlene in Connecticut. President Obama was accused of being a Vulcan at one time, i.e. Mr. Spock. And if you recall, Spock said in the fourth movie that to destroy an entire species was not logical. Indeed. Still trying to figure out, I mean, Trump doesn't even qualify as a fucking Ferengi. Andorian, maybe? I don't know. Maybe we just haven't met those creatures yet. You know, the barbarian morons from Planet Trump 4 or some such. Lady B said simply, he gives me chills. Yeah. Yeah. And just to sort of riff on the word she used, it is chilling to realize how rapidly a nation can go to the dogs. I mean, we're in year three of this maladministration. And look how much damage has been done, such that it is... going to be the work of a generation to reverse what has already been done. Oh, and by the way, going back to the business with the, since it is prayer meeting Wednesday, to the shrine of John Paul II, it is worth taking into account that that sorry piece of theater, bad theater, took place not in a consecrated church space, but rather at a, for all intents and purposes, tourist trap. They got a big statue to John Paul II, who was as authoritarian a pope as the modern world has seen. Brutally, you know, he came to prominence when he stood in support of the Solidarity movement in Poland that toppled the Polish communist regime, and then set about squashing like bugs the hopes and dreams of liberation theologians in the Roman Catholic Church, particularly in Central and South America. So there's that. But it's a tourist trap run by the Knights of Columbus. And the Knights of Columbus, in turn, are the Roman Catholic equivalent of the Masonic Lodge. They got secret handshakes and the ceremonial swords and shit like that. And they are typically a reactionary and right-wing outfit. I mean, for God's sakes, it's 2020, and there's still an organization out there that's named for and calls themselves Knights of a man who was personally responsible for the front end of a genocide that wiped out more than 20 million innocent human beings. I mean, can't they find somebody else to be the Knights of? Isn't there somebody within Roman Catholicism more worthy of the veneration of guys who like to get drunk on New Year's Eve than Christopher Columbus? You know, the first big named storm of the season formed in the Gulf of Campeche, and it was named Cristobal, which, of course, is another word for Christopher. And it slammed into the Mexican coast, bringing drenching rain, drenching, devastating rain. And, you know, how apropos, huh? And so the Archbishop called out the goons of the Trump administration. Like I said, it was kind of a moment there with the Episcopals and the Roman Catholic leadership agreeing that their sacred ground was being defaced by the walking monstrosity that is Donald Trump. David in South Carolina, Stan, let me know that they have now parked United States military vehicles, lo and behold, in front of St. John's Episcopal Church as a sort of fuck you show of force. And this, there was a powerful moment in that video conference where I forget which participant it was pointed out that the history of policing in the United States is a history of white supremacy and the history of slave catching patrols. I mean, we could talk, for instance, about the Fugitive Slave Act. We could talk about the fact that the bullies and thugs of the South coerced northern states into being active participants in their slave hunting. It's real. But then something else dawned on me. And we go back to 1927 for this because we've talked about it a great deal. And that is that Klan riot in Jamaica, Queens in 1927, in which Fred Trump was one of the ones who was arrested. And in fact, according to newspaper accounts of the time, he was arrested in full Klan regalia. the sheet and the pillowcase. And we need to remember that that is Klan 2.0. The federal government was largely successful in crushing Klan 1.0 during the Grant administration. We've talked about that based upon his on the History Channel three-night docudrama. He succeeded in largely running Klan 1.0 to earth. The violence continued, but the Knight Riders and the Klansmen, the Klansmen were prosecuted. But Klan 2.0 was born out of a broader sense of hate. And this was the Klan that marched in its tens of thousands down Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C. in the early 1920s. The Klan rally, the Klan riot, where Fred Trump was busted, was not aimed at people of color. If you want to do the legwork of digging it up, you'll find that that Klan rally in 1927 in Jamaica, Queens, was aimed at the NYPD. Now, Fred Trump was the son of a pimp and a coward who had tried to leave America and go back to Germany, and the Germans said, no. You dodged the draft, and so fuck you, leave. And so he took his new bride, went to America. Trump's grandfather, and then got all dead in the 1918-1919 flu pandemic. And young Fred grew along and nurtured by his mama, built up his little real estate empire. And then in 1927, flyers went around that, by God, good God, fair and Protestant white Americans were not going to tolerate these goddamned Irish taking over these papist mackerel snapping. Roman Catholic Irish taking over the New York Police Department. And of course, everybody knows the fact that there is a strong Irish tradition inside the NYPD. And in fact, for a very long time, there was a DNA test for all intents and purposes to get into the NYPD. And that DNA test required having relatives who were previously in the NYPD and traced their origins back to the Emerald Isle. Because joining up in the brand new or the new-ish NYPD was a way for the Irish to become, for lack of a better term, white. Because in the latter part of the in the 19th century, they were routinely portrayed in places like Collier's by cartoonists who drew them as, wait for it, monkeys, apes, subhumans, and so becoming part of the burgeoning NYPD, they provided a little bit of protection for themselves. And prior to that, during the Civil War draft riots, you must remember that the Irish were largely participants in that because they were being sent off to fight a war without hardly having gotten their feet wet here. And so when the draft riots struck New York City, the Irish set about killing any black person or beating, maiming, killing any black person they could set their hands upon. And eventually we get to 1927 and a bunch of aggrieved white folks who rioted against the New York Police Department. And that is how Donald Trump's filthy old father found himself getting arrested by the very police against whom he was violently protesting. He was one of those violent thugs and a member of the fucking Klan. And as Brother Deacon Asa points out, as a matter of fact, Frederick Trump, Don's grandpappy, started running his whorehouse right here in British Columbia, catering to the miners and the gold rush rubes or entrepreneurs. Yeah, it's all, you know, that's the Trump modus operandi. Don't ever do the actual hard work. Just exploit and take money from the people who are. It's a rather eventful evening. Jeremy with a query, subject line white, can we, and by not, and I mean not the horn, but I mean as a nation, move forward and start calling these neo-Nazi fucks cute names like the Boogaloo Boys or white separatists or white nationalists? They're all Nazi scum and should be recognized as such. And I will sign on to that with a hearty hell yeah. As for the what Star Trek people do the Trumps come from? Ron and Raleigh says, I'd say more like a Tellarite, you know, the species that look like pigs. Okay, there's a suggestion. Who else? Dave in the Blind says, I have a candidate for a species, Star Trek, that would be the equivalent of Trump and his ilk. You're forgetting the Paclid? They steal technology and they're not quite smart enough to handle it, but they claim to be smart and they claim to be in the right while they steal. You may have just nailed it. Not sure on the name there. Darlene, third Star Trek reference. Okay, I'm on a roll here. Even the Romulans are classier than Trump. Trump is more like the killer cloud that sucked the red corpuscles from the body. That was the 1967 episode called Obsession. Kirk encountered the dastardly creature in his youth and came across it again on some obscure barren planet when he was captain of the Enterprise. It took a lot, but Kirk, with Spock's help, destroyed it. Speaking of which, it was enhanced to a certain extent. I think it was our buddy Texas T who drew it to my attention. But you remember that? You remember the episode? And it looked like a great big craggy funnel that was all energy inside, and it gobbled up planets and stuff like that. And William Wyndham was the mad captain, and he eventually escaped shuttle or something and flew it into the maw of the thing and blew it up. Well, there was, you never know how much these things are manipulated. But it purported to be a photograph taken by the Hubble Space Telescope of a gaseous area of the galaxy. And, you know, computer enhanced for color and all of that. Some wiseacre went, damn. And lo and behold, with a little more resolution, it looks like that thing that the Enterprise encountered that looked like a giant intergalactic cornucopia that was gobbling planets. Little delights. What a contrast, says Steve in New York. Trump's clan granddaddy. Clandaddy. At least his clandaddy didn't hide in a bunker in a diaper with the lights off, sucking his thumb. Remember, Steve, that's not a bunker. That's a spider hole. Henceforward, anywhere that Trump goes to hide is a spider hole. And speaking of which, he later tried to justify his time huddling, shitting his depends in the spider hole. as, I went down to inspect it. Subject line, Washington Journal, Jack in Shreveport says, oh yeah, you set me up for this one when you mentioned Fred Trump. The subject this morning on C-SPAN Washington Journal was how people thought race relations could be fixed. A person making the point of how people learn hate or bigotry mentioned that Trump's daddy was in the Klan. The host quickly asserted that there is no evidence for that. The hosts don't usually question statements by callers, but the caller said, oh yeah, it's true. It's been researched. There is evidence for it. Was that Steve or was that Pedro that did such an awful job, Jack? Oh, okay. Well, Lou's got another nominee for where the Trumps come from. How about that little bug, the SETI eel larva that crawled into Chekhov's ear, brain, and Wrath of Khan and made Chekhov do crazy things? It was Kipton. It was terrible. They put things in her ears. Trying to, Todd. Todd with a note saying, preach the history, Bob. Preach the truth. If it feels uncomfortable for some, they should welcome themselves to the club. But there's some other rather significant breaking news at the hour as we move into the third hour of the program. Oh, and by the way, earlier Kyle pointed out, the fact that Trump actually now has prison guards surrounding the White House is to me at least a sign that he's more scared about the peaceful protests making him look bad than he is about actually making good on his threat to use even more force to crack down. He might have a reason. All right, Steve in New York says, I'm going to vote that the maggots are like tribbles. They're stupid, mush-filled beings that just get into cracks and crevices, screwing everything up without actually adding value to anything. Well, remember, Steve, we're limiting this explicitly to where do Trumps come from, not where do maggots come from. Where do Trumps come from? But Nitwit Nero is probably a little bit unsettled by a statement that was issued today. Back in December of 2018, when former General James Mattis quit the cabinet in protest of Clorox Claudius's bungled approach to the question of Syria, he said that the president had earned his silence for a time. He said, that he would maintain his silence so that others could try to do the necessary work of governing. He caught a lot of heat for that, and I think he deserved every damn bit of it. He said, when you leave an administration over clear policy differences, you need to give the people who are still there as much opportunity as possible to defend the country. They still have the responsibility of protecting this great big experiment of ours. There is a period in which I owe my silence. It's not eternal. It's not going to be forever. And as of this evening, the third day of June 2020, it's over. It bears reading. He said, I have watched this week's unfolding events angry and appalled. The words equal justice under law are carved in the pediment of the United States Supreme Court. This is precisely what protesters are rightly demanding. It is a wholesome and unifying demand, one that all of us should be able to get behind. We must not be distracted by a small number of lawbreakers. The protests are defined by tens of thousands of people of conscience who are insisting that we live up to our values as people, and our values as a nation. When I joined the military some 50 years ago, I swore an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Never did I dream that troops Never did I dream that troops taking that same oath would be ordered under any circumstances to violate the constitutional rights of their fellow citizens, much less to provide a bizarre photo op for the elected commander-in-chief with military leadership standing alongside. That right there is a shot right across the bow of General Mark Milley, all four stars worth of him, who was right there waddling alongside COVID Caligula as he took Bible. Is it your Bible, sir?
It's a Bible.
When he took Bible over to the church and held it up like a mullah before a slavering throng of religious maniacs. So that's a little note there that Mark Milley better find a cushy place to land in Maggotville, because he's not on the Christmas card list anymore when he's no longer an active duty general. Mattis continues, we must reject any thinking of our cities as a battle space that our uniformed military is called upon to dominate. And that's a shot at Mark Esper, who turned tail and ran today. He and Mike Pompeo, who graduated first in his class at West Point, it just never gets old. Huh. They graduated together at West Point, Esper and Pompeo. And by the way, just a quick digression on the name Pompeo. Todd says, preach the history and preach the truth. Okay, here's a little more. It is decidedly difficult, if not outright impossible, to trace bloodlines much past the Renaissance. But some things do echo down the eons. And Mike Pompeo is one such example. Might be, at least. By Roman tradition, oh fuck, he's off to Rome again. By Roman tradition, Roman slaves, and it was not, and their slavery was not what Southern slavery became, chattel slavery, born into that kind, no. One could buy one's way out of slavery in ancient Rome. People often sold themselves into it, especially academics, so as to have a decent life while they taught the young scions of the Roman nobility. And it was traditional, upon manumission, for the slave who had bought his or her freedom, and during the pendency of slavery, to take the name of the family of the slave owner. It's revolting even to talk about this, but it's history and it's real. And so, to the extent that slavery was invented by the Spanish and the Portuguese, primarily, initially, they followed that Latin tradition and some names still remained in circulation. Antonius. as in Mark Antony, was a family. Antony was a family name, not somebody's first name. Paulus. And in for our cases, most famously, Pompeius. Gets shortened in anglicized accounts to Pompey. And the first one was Pompey Carnifex, which meant Pompey the Butcher. He was a general who had no scruples against engaging in just wholesale slaughter, whether it was necessary or not. And his son, a son of privilege, became known as Pompeius Magnus. And for a time, he was thought to be quite the hero because he cleared the Mediterranean of pirates who were preying upon Roman shipping. Pompeius Magnus, of course, proved no match for Julius Caesar in the Civil War and wound up having his head removed from his shoulders at the orders of a young pharaoh by the name of Ptolemy, who was the brother of Cleopatra. But there's every reason to think that it could very well be that Mike Pompeo is the bearer of a slave name. Just hung on to it over the generations. And it's worth remembering that Malcolm X became Malcolm X because he rejected that whole concept of taking the name of the slave owner. That X, the X that he adopted, represents a placeholder for the history that was stolen from him. So it could well be that that just dawned on me the other day, and I thought I would share it. Mike Pompeo running around with a slave name. Yeah. Getting back to General Mattis's statement, you get the idea that it's sad that it took him this long. You know, if he had led, for all intents and purposes, what we might call a palace coup, he had the moral and leadership authority to drive people to go to Mike Pencilneck Geek and say, "You've got the signatures necessary. We're ready to make you acting president. The Republic is at hazard." But he didn't. Silence has consequences. Steve in New York says, okay, I got no love lost regarding Mattis because he took too long to speak out, but this latest is basically a poke in the eye to everyone around Trump, up to the death yam himself. Precisely. Calling out Esper and Milley again, he says, "We must reject any thinking of our cities as a battle space that our uniformed military is called upon to dominate. At home, we should use our military only when requested to do so, on very rare occasions by state governors. Militarizing our response, as we witnessed in Washington, D.C., sets up a conflict, a false conflict, between the military and civilian society. It erodes the moral ground that ensures a trusted bond between men and women in uniform and the society they are sworn to protect and of which they themselves are a part. Keeping public order rests with civilian state and local leaders who best understand their communities and are answerable to them." James Madison wrote in Federalist 14 that America, united with a handful of troops or without a single soldier, exhibits a more forbidding posture to foreign ambition than America disunited with 100,000 veterans ready for combat. We do not need to militarize our response to protests. We need to unite around a common purpose. And it starts by guaranteeing that all of us are equal before the law. Instructions given by the military departments to our troops before the Normandy invasion reminded soldiers that the Nazi slogan for destroying us was divide and conquer. Our American answer is, in union, there is strength. We must summon that unity to surmount this crisis, confident that we are better than our politics. Donald Trump is the first president in my lifetime who does not try to unite the American people, does not even pretend to try. Instead, he tries to divide us. We're witnessing the consequences of 3 years of this deliberate effort. We're witnessing the consequences of 3 years without mature leadership. We can unite without him, drawing on the strengths inherent in our civil society. This will not be easy, as the past few days have shown, but we owe it to our fellow citizens, to past generations that bled to defend our promise, and to our children. We can come through this trying time stronger and with a renewed sense of purpose and respect for one another. The pandemic has shown us that it is not only our troops who are willing to offer the ultimate sacrifice for the safety of the community. Americans in hospitals, grocery stores, post offices, and elsewhere have put their lives on the line in order to serve their fellow citizens in their country. We know that we are better than the abuse of executive authority that we have witnessed in Lafayette Park. Almost sounds like Mattis is saying that what he did in Lafayette Park would be, dare say, impeachable? We must reject and hold accountable those in office who would make a mockery of our Constitution. At the same time, we must remember Lincoln's better angels and listen to them as we work to unite. Only by adopting a new path, which means, in truth, returning to the original path of our founding ideals, will we again be a country admired and respected at home and abroad. Inherent in that claim, of course, is the idea that we are no longer respected at home and abroad. The other night, as that one outbuilding burned in Lafayette Park, the spray painters had gotten to it. They didn't tag the building with "Justice for George Floyd." They tagged the building where it would show on every camera view taken of it, up by the roof line, "Fuck Trump." And there's a hell of a lot of freight in that. Oh, and by the way, Mike Esper showed himself to have all the courage of a typical maggot. The Secretary of Defense said, I think we can send the troops home. They don't need to be in Washington, D.C. And his happy ass was dragged into the Oval Office. And he backed away and said, nope, not going to send them home. They definitely need to stay in Washington, D.C. Definitely in Washington, D.C. Chicken shit. Resign. But that's okay. That's okay. He has no reputation to lose now, Mike Esper. Mike in Cascadia writes and says, Operation Themis. I heard U.S. forces in D.C. are operating under an official mission, Operation Themis, Greek mythology, Themis, divine law and order, divine law and order. That's got bars, fingerprints all over it. Cheers from Mike, mowing the lawn in Cascadia. I'll bet it's a lovely evening for doing that. We've had three straight lovely days here. I guess the thunderstorms start tonight, perhaps tomorrow. But I have certainly enjoyed it here. I love the smell of new mown grass. Enjoy it, Mike. Themis. Yeah, it does. And, of course, Attorney General Bill Pepe the Frog Barr is a religious maniac anyway. And something else, it could be a play on words. T-H-E-M-I-S, them is. In other words, a notion that that the military are to treat the protesters as other, them, they, those people. And there it is, almost in real time. Nitwit Nero taking to the Twitter to threaten the country. He retweeted Tom Cotton, you know, the guy who wanted to attack peaceful protesters using the 82nd Airborne. The nation must restore order. The military stands ready. Well, who the fuck are you, Tom Cotton? You're just a senator. Sit down and stay in your goddamn lane and pump your brakes till they're on the floor like stepping on a fucking plum. You skinny-ass little turd. By the way, the individual whose name will remain unspoken says, I was back in the same building today and the same government building and saw my friend who talked to me about the 400 Nazi groups who threaten our way of life. He acknowledged that, yes, indeed, Nazis have become entwined in our military and especially police. It's a real problem, and we need people who smell a turd to speak up and say, I smell a turd. Stephen, New York, asks, might Mattis's piece portend a turning point? I doubt it. I mean, he's putting out there what he should have said in December 2018. The man's unfit for office. And yet he couldn't even say that in this statement. In a country that operates on stylized language, you have to use the magic words. I don't know about all jurisdictions, but for instance, in the state of West Virginia, if a grand jury issues an indictment and that indictment does not state that the crime was committed against the peace and dignity of the people of the state of West Virginia, that indictment is null and void. No matter how solid the evidence, no matter how clear-cut the case, that indictment is null and void because it failed to use the magic words. The incantation failed. And so, with Mattis failing to use the magic words, unfit to fulfill the duties of his office, it's just shouting down a rain barrel. That's all. Ah, okay, a little follow-up on the nature of Themis. Renee in D.C. tells us, per Wikipedia, Themis is an ancient Greek Titaness. She is described as the Lady of Good Counsel, personification of divine order, fairness, law, natural law. Her symbols are the scales of justice. Themis means divine law rather than human ordinance. And, of course, that's the way that Attorney General Bill Pepe the Frog Barr operates. We don't need no stinking civil order. We got religious rules. Yeah, he's a theocrat. If Iran were a Christian nation, he might well have long since immigrated, because they're right up his. Right up his alley. And so the program is almost to the point of being done. If you've got something you'd like to get said, you're more than welcome to say it. And yes, Steve from Georgistan reminds us that it was an enjoyable evening yesterday when the news broke out of the Iowa primary that come January, Steve Cantaloupe's king, the poster boy for Republican white supremacy, had been defeated in his primary. He lost his primary to some member of the Iowa State Legislature. The upside is that, well, we won't have Steve Cantaloupe's king to kick around anymore. The downside is that the guy who is going to be on the ballot for that district as the Republican nominee is almost just as awful. Almost. And going back to Barack Obama, Flavio points out he was thwarted at every turn. Mitch McConnell did everything to thwart Obama throughout his tenure in the White House. You remember that meeting? Who all was there? McConnell was there. Jim Demented, former senator of South Carolina, was there. And they all swore the day after Obama was sworn in that they would do everything in their power to make him a one-term president and not let him have any legislative achievements whatsoever. I think that's damn near treasonous. To say that you're just going to thwart somebody before you even know what they're going to do. As Flavio notes, Mitch vowed to make Obama a one-term president, and when he couldn't, he settled for making him three-fifths of a president. And he still accomplished a hell of a lot, given the disloyal opposition he endured throughout his tenure. True. And something else coming out of that, electronic meeting that we eavesdropped on. Can't wait for eight. Those eight principles. Well, I guess it wouldn't be the best. Those eight principles wouldn't be an appropriate place to say something about firearms. But as long as we have a firearms pandemic in this country, the damn thing is the police will demand that they have to have better weapons than the bad guys do. And when the bad guys have access to every kind of sidearm short of fully automatic weapons, you know, with an AR-15, you still have to squeeze the trigger. You can't just squeeze and hold. Then the police are going to demand that they have armored personnel carriers and tanks and machine guns and can look every bit like a military force. Jesus, where was it? Boston or was it D.C.? Where the fucking Black Hawk helicopters took down trees, blew trees down, caused property damage with tree limbs falling down onto people's vehicles and homes. Oopsie. Oh, and that's another thing. Thanks for reminding me of it, Lou. In the last 24 hours, Tangerine Tiberius threw a fit and declared that
the Republican National Convention is no longer going to be held in North Carolina because their Democrat Governor Roy Cooper won't let us turn the arena in Charlotte into a massive vector to burn North Carolina to the ground by using COVID-19 as a biological weapon. We're going somewhere where freedom is,
or drivel to that effect. Because they wanted to cram 50,000 people into that arena and make sure lots and lots and lots of people got sick and some percentage of them fucking died. And, you know, that's a reality. Because 10 days ago, out in Idaho, they held an in-person religious event with everybody smolicking all over themselves, LARPing and tossing and hosanna and putting their hands in the air and waving and spewing viral particles all about one another in the name of Jesus. It was the Idaho Falls Potter's House Christian Center on Lomax Street. And they didn't just have one night of Jesusing. They had several days of revival. Because I guess the congregation there wasn't sufficiently vived, so they had to revive them. It's toward the end of this past month. And then, lo and behold, a few days later, a whole bunch of people had the Rona. Yep. Turns out at least 41 people from 12 households who attended the revival are being interviewed. 11 have been absolutely positively found to have COVID-19. 6 more cases are thought to be probable. And then 13 more people from neighboring counties who felt the need for getting revivaled, they tested positive for COVID-19 too. Meanwhile, the Eastern Idaho Public Health spokeswoman, Mimi Taylor, declared, "It can happen to anyone." But see, that's the problem. It can't. If you don't go to the Potter's House Christian Center on Lomax Street and get all revivaled up and smolic and LARP hair tossel and give the kiss of peace and the hug of friendship and all of that crap, and you remain socially distant, you wear your mask and you wash your hands, and you stay home where possible, and you take all the precautions, then it's probably not going to happen to anybody. It happens to people who go out and put themselves at fucking risk. It happens, among other things, to stupid, 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 stupid Christians and other churchy people. And I still fear that what we're going to see in about 2 weeks is going to make what happened in New York look like child's play. I mean, again, they've shut down my favorite sausage factory in a little town called Evergreen, Alabama. because they had to reopen. Donald Trump wants us to reopen. If they ever closed at all. And now they don't have enough people to actually staff the sausage plant. Yeah, I know. It's not the best example in the world. It's not going to be the end of human existence. But if that's the case, how many different vectors are there for the disease out of that plant? You tell me. Yeah, Flavio pointing out that the militarization of the police goes back at least as far as Seattle. Remember the anti-globalization marches in Seattle in 1999? Remember Occupy Wall Street? Yeah. But having mentioned, we had Barack Obama at the beginning of the program. And I'll go to the phones in just a minute, but I got to share something with you. It's a Make West Virginia Great Big Old Governor Jim Justice update. I noticed when I went over to pick up my prescriptions yesterday that there's a big old trailer parked at the intersection of the road that turns toward Summersville Lake and U.S. 19. And in big old letters, it says Trump Justice. In other words, it's a Jim Justice campaign ad with our primary coming up. And it shows a big blown up photo of Make West Virginia Great Big Old Governor Jim Justice in the Oval Office. And when Jim Justice sits around the Oval Office, he really sits around the Oval Office. And that idea of Trump Justice sort of took on a whole brand new meaning, because he went to war against the American people. But for some reason or another, Make West Virginia Great Big Old Governor Jim Justice felt the need to unburden himself of his feelings about the Republican National Convention. Let's be clear, neither Charleston nor Morgantown nor Huntington, nor Parkersburg nor Clarksburg, nor even Martinsburg, has anywhere near the capacity to host the Republican National Convention or barely a maggot rally at the Charleston Civic Center. But Jim just wanted to get a word in to let his dear, dear friend, Donald J. Trump, the J stands for Honorary Hillbilly. He'd be welcome here most any time. Yeah. Get the hockey puck.
He wanted to call me and let me know, you know, that it looks like they're going to go another way. I knew it was a giant long shot and everything. But I wanted West Virginia at least to be on the radar. And so you know, that's the thing. We talk frequently, but we
wait
just don't
it.
Talk to chatter. I wanted him to always know just how welcome he is in West Virginia. And any president, you know, we should absolutely welcome all, but, you know, maybe not Barack Obama. But nevertheless, we'll welcome any president. You know.
Yeah, maybe not Barack Obama. He's a Negro. Yeah. You know what? You know why God created Donald Trump instead of Kunta Kinte? Because he wanted Donald Trump to make America great again. Instead, he made that Barack Obama like Kunta Kinte. You fucking asshole. You goddamn dick. You racist shit stain. It ain't easy being a West Virginian. And sometimes he makes it a hell of a lot harder than it has to be. Make West Virginia great big old Governor Jim Justice. Fuck me running. Maybe not Barack Obama. You know, it made me want to, just as a West Virginian, say, hey, Barack, come on down here. You'll be surprised how welcome you'll be. I'll make you some of the best barbecue you ever ate in your life. We'll have biscuits and dirty gravy for breakfast in the morning. Hey, we'll take you down and show you some of those mountaintop removal sites you didn't stop from taking place. But that, you know, we're buddies. The very notion of saying that any former president of the United States would not be welcome here. Resign, you sad old bastard. Hey, we haven't heard from Devin in forever. Hey, Devin.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing, my friend?
Am I coming through okay and all that?
Oh, you're magnificent. You sound great. Sound like you're in the next room. But Agnes is in there, so I know you're not.
Well, I better not be.
Probably for all of our sakes.
Yeah, about the sausage factory, you know it's not kosher. So,
well, that be sure, it's pork. I mean, come on. But then again, yeah. I am not held to those rules. Lucky me.
Yeah. Well, you know, you got to watch out for the shellfish and the polyester and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
But I thought it was really interesting. Minneapolis, where the mayor said that, you know, hey, you cops, you know, take it easy, de-escalate. And they turned around and got their union to say, that's not a lawful order. We're going to ignore you.
We're going to have a police riot just the same.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what happened to civilian control?
Oh, that's so powdered wigs and knee breeches, Devin.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, basically, the police force is a career extension service for the military, anyways.
Yeah, and you got to remember, good old Smedley Butler always comes in handy in so many instances.
Yeah.
Did you know that he got the Congressional Medal of Honor. And he admitted it straight up, for serving as a corporate enforcer for United Fruit in Nicaragua in the early part of the 20th century. But before he went down there and did that, for a time he was the police commissioner of Philadelphia. Do you know that? So he learned about breaking skulls on the streets of Philadelphia. And then I think, if I've got the timeline right, went back into the Marine Corps and went down and broke skulls in Nicaragua.
It's not surprising. I mean, they really like smashing skulls in Philadelphia. I mean, you know, just ask, move.
Yeah. Oh, I've got because of the way things are situated here, you couldn't hear it, but I've got video from the Philly 14th District, where a group of about four cops were rioting on top of this black dude, and he hollered, "I can't breathe," and one cop hollered back, "That shit don't work here. Where do you think you are?" And continued to you know, crush him.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe they should take a very old page out of the book, and instead of saying, I can't breathe, just say, more weight.
Giles Corey. Yeah.
He
popped up in conversation a few days ago.
Yeah, he was a hard ass, apparently.
Yeah, he was a mean bastard. He had he had previously killed an indentured servant for leaving the premises, I believe, if I recall correctly. And the folks there in Massachusetts said, "Well, it was only an indentured servant, so it ain't really murder. So go about your business."
Well, he had money and.
Amazing what that'll do,
isn't
it? All
that nice stuff.
How you holding up these days?
Ironically, if they had gotten him to confess when they were crushing him, the sheriff would have ended up with his property and whatnot.
Oh, so that's why. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I figured
I figured they would have just taken the rocks off of him.
I figured they would have just taken the rocks off of him and hanged him.
Yeah, probably. Or burn him at the stake. Or
I think all the witches in Salem were hanged. I don't think there were actually any burnings. I could be wrong. Well, just out of curiosity, I haven't heard from you.
He would have been the crown jewel, so you know, maybe they would have bothered to chop some wood. I don't know.
Are you getting along okay? How have you been dealing with the pandemic? Just staying home?
Well, I do stay at home, but except for going to the doctor. Of course, I live with my parents, and they're both essential workers, so...
Oh, dear.
You know, it doesn't make much difference to stay at home. My mother is an essential worker at the hospital, works as a clerk, you know, to take people's money. So she's the one that people come up there and, you know, scream at her and stuff.
Breathe all over.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, I'm pretty sure I've already had it. I had something that was really weird, and it's probably it. But the symptoms were, you know, an atypical version. A small percentage of people, it will attack their digestive tract. And it was bad. I've had pretty much, you know, every creeping crud that affects the... you know, lungs and stomach and stuff, and for people who don't know,
you were a lab tech and were exposed to some pretty noxious chemicals a while back, and that was the beginning of your troubles, right?
Well, it turns out that the heart issue was a genetic mutation that affects many systems in my body, but particularly it messes with my nerves. So it's probably a big part of why I have so much pain. my muscles, they move around at incredible speed. It's kind of like whole body restless leg, but it's so fast you can't see it. So, ultra short twitch muscle movements, which is why I was able to, be able to go outside in freezing cold weather with nothing but a pair of shorts or something, and why I was able to eat crazy amounts of calories and not get any fatter. Once I went on the Valium for the muscle spasms, because nothing else would really work, I put on 100 pounds. And I'm cold all the time.
Well, I read an article the other day that pointed out that researchers are now finding out that COVID-19 also affects the blood vessel linings themselves.
Yes. I did have, for a few days, I had trouble with my breathing. I noticed that I was breathing a lot more frequently, which is one of those signs that it's a way to tell that you've got a COVID kind of problem. Of course, I didn't have an oximeter. I never got around to buying one, so I couldn't check what I was running, but it was definitely affecting my lungs, but it's not like any pneumonia or anything I've ever had, because there was no congestion. It was just like there's less air in my air. So I wasn't getting as much oxygen absorption. And then I had the horrible stomach issues. I was nauseated for like a week and a half.
Oh, Jesus.
And no diarrhea, no vomiting, just
sick at your gut.
Wicked nausea that would not go away. And I lost my sense of smell and sense of taste.
That's a big one.
I mean, when I sat down and looked at all the symptoms, it's like, this is pretty likely COVID-19. Just, I didn't have the, one of the reasons that a lot of people will end up on the ventilator and never be able to come off of it is because of essentially it causes a neurological attack. It can cause a form of meningitis. It can also cause what they call polio now, it could cause a form of polio. I'm trying. I can't remember the technical name, but in effect, it's polio without the polio virus. Jesus. And that will shut down your ability to breathe. And of course, you know what kills the people once that happens is using a positive pressure ventilator will destroy your lungs. Now, if they had the old iron lung, a lot of these people would still be alive.
You think?
Yeah, because the iron lung made your lungs work the proper way because it pulled vacuum on your body and expanded your chest cavity.
Interesting.
So... yeah, they, you know, it is interesting that they designed a medical device that worked with the body rather than against it.
Yeah.
And
no, I mean,
there aren't any.
Well, no, I know. Well, it's the ever compelling drive to compete design a new machine that goes ping. And I know you know your Monty Python.
Yeah. And to make it cheaper.
My mom was on and less space consuming too. Mom was on one for months until the bugs got in, and yeah, because you eventually get pneumonia with a vent. So the numbers run about 80% mortality for COVID-19 patients who go on a ventilator.
Yes.
Got to be really strong to survive.
Of course, a lot of places they've been putting people on ventilators who didn't necessarily need a ventilator. They didn't want to deal with it. So they just, okay, sign this paper, and then they knock them out and put a ventilator in, and they'll run this big long hose out into the hallway, and they'll put the ventilator and the IVs and everything out there, and then they just won't attend to the patient until the patient, you know, dies.
Where did you see this?
There have been some whistleblowers. I mean, it's probably on Twitter. I heard about it on Peak Prosperity, that doctor who's been doing a thorough analysis about COVID-19 ever since it was just a little thing in China. But, you know, he goes into like detail about the RNA and you know, deep into virology. It's pretty interesting. It's on YouTube.
Okay.
Of course, you know, not everything he says toes the standard line, but you know, he goes into the science and it explains how he gets to where he gets via, you know, logic, not orthodoxy. So that's, you know, that's worth checking out, Peak Prosperity. And one other thing, he always ends his videos with Plant a Garden. Because food shortages are going to be a thing coming forward.
Well, there's never a bad reason to plant a garden.
Exactly.
A fresh tomato alone is worth the effort.
Even if it's a window planter, you know, plant some food. You know, it's a good thing.
Well, Devin, it's good to hear from you. I'm glad you're hanging in there and keeping. Are you doing any stargazing lately?
Not for a bit. I had while I was sick, I had to have my pacemaker replaced. So I can't lift it, you know, lift anything right now. And that was quite the trip. One, they didn't want to test me. They were just fine, you know, carving on me, you know, one way or the other. And they decided to do vivisection rather than proper medicine. I was completely unanesthetized, and the doctor did a local with a large bore needle, stabbed me about 20 times. He put down the needle, he picked up the plasma cutter, and did a plunge cut with a plasma cutter, which is, you know, you don't do that because the gases have to go somewhere. And he was burning away on me. You know, I felt every last little bubble of plasma and steam, and you know, he burnt down. Well, he took about five long cuts and numerous, you know, cleanups. They finally decided to knock me out after they were done with the plasma cutter. But you know, nothing for pain, or you know, it was just running late, so he thought, hey, I can make up some time by torturing somebody.
Well, you are a West Virginian, Devin, so we have to be extra super double plus good careful to make sure that you don't become an addict.
Yeah.
Because you know, hillbillies have the possibility of getting all addicted. Like,
they had the line in. They could have at least given me the, you know, Michael Jackson treatment. You know, for
some milk of amnesia
when I was on the table.
Yeah, a little dose of milk of amnesia. Sure.
Yeah. I mean. If I were, you know, a little bit litigious, I would think I could, you know, make things unpleasant for them.
How long ago was that?
It's just, I don't know, 2 weeks ago.
Oh, Jesus. Well, Talk to a reputable practitioner. Probably your best bet would probably, I guess, be what, Morgantown?
Sorry, I missed what you said.
I said check out a reputable practitioner. Probably be your best bet would be in Morgantown. Too long to go to Charleston. You know, lawyer up.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
All right, Devin.
Well, maybe we could talk about that
sure.
off.
sure.
air.
Absolutely. And stay safe and stay well. And, oh, God, be careful. It's just a damn dangerous time. I'm looking at a story here where an Oklahoma State football player, Oklahoma State University, has announced he's tested positive for COVID-19 after attending a protest in Tulsa. Even though he, you know, wore his mask and everything, he still came up with positive test for COVID-19 because he was in such close proximity to people. And he just said, after attending a protest in Tulsa and being well protective of myself, I've tested positive for COVID-19. Please, if you're going to protest, take care of yourself and stay safe. Oh, God. 2 weeks from now, I have a feeling 2 weeks from now is going to be really creepy. Devin, take care of yourself, and I hope we will talk soon, all right?
All right, thank you, and be careful out there.
Yeah, trying. Later, Devin. Haven't heard from Devin in a while. Good to hear from him. And so we come to the end of the program. Thank you all so kindly for sharing your precious finite time engaging in the program in whatever manner you so choose. Thanks to all of you who keep the program on the air. Thanks to our PayPal and Patreon subscribers, to our a la carte contributors, and people who, and you know, there are several who work, who do some combination of the above. Thank you. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to midweek part-time utility chat room moderator and all-around great guy, Steve, and, from Georgia Stan in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. 20-plus years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Stay home, stay safe, wear your mask, wash your hands, wear your gloves, maintain social distancing. And if you see a maggot, avoid them like the plague, because they are. Later, y'all.